how the hell do I live up to that? My name is Bob Olson, and I'm an alcoholic. It's by the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that I haven't found a need or an excuse to take a drink today, nor have I found a need or an excuse to take a drink since May 28th of 1973. I am a member of the Happy Way group in Englewood, Colorado, and I didn't pick the name. Sounds like a bunch of people on Thorazine. I would much rather it was called the Beaten Into a State of Reasonableness group, or the Outright Mental Defectives. As goofy as that name sounds, we're kind of the book thumpers in Denver. Members in our group go through the steps once a year. We have a real interest in whether the recovery program in Alcoholics Anonymous will do what it says it's going to do, which not only will stop you from drinking, but can turn your life around and make you the person that God intended you to be. And so we spend a lot of time going back through that process and seeing what the result is. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous the last time in 1973. I started going to AA meetings in 1968. I'm a retread. I just didn't get it. I was drinking a fifth a day from the time I was about 25 years old. And I did that for 10 years. And about five of those, I went to AA meetings. And I would go in the AA meetings. I'd get into self-pity. And I'd start feeling bad, and I'd go, I'm going to have to turn myself into AA. And I wasn't quite sure what the deal was. But I would go to an AA meeting, and I would sit in a corner and look like I'd had a hard time. And people would come up and stroke me and tell me I was going to be all right. And that keep coming back. And we'll love you till you can love yourself. And bring the body and the mind will follow. And all kinds of bullshit that just... And God bless everybody. I mean, I didn't have any better message than they did. So it was, and then I'd feel much better for having done that, and I'd get drunk and go home. Don't blow smoke up somebody's backside in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a bad thing to do. It really is. This is a horrible disease, and it terminates in insanity or death. And trying to blow smoke up some new drunk's backside is a terrible waste of time, and you're really doing them a disservice. And if 35 years of sobriety has taught me anything, it's that so many people in our fellowship miss the point. And the point is that you can have so much more than you do have. And there is so much here to give you the kind of mental health. And this is not a not drinking contest. This is recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous only starts with sobriety. From that point forward, all that silly stuff that's floating around in our heads has to go away. All that stuff I believe about who I am and what I am has to go down the road. because I am not who I think I am. You know, we come into Alcoholics Anonymous without a clue about who we are. I have never, ever met anyone who came into this program who had any kind of a reasonable estimation of what kind of a person they were. The basic underlying truth about all of this is we are all children of God, and we are all equals. And the only thing that we have to be equals to is God. God is the benchmark. And as a child of God, I am an equal to anyone on the face of this planet, and so are you, and it's about damn time you claimed it. Last time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, my wife had left. We had two sons. She went to Europe with the two kids, and I wound up, I'd gone on a 1 week blackout, and I wound up back in this house we lived in on the floor. And two guys came from the AA group and 12-stepped me. One of them was a guy that had said he would be my sponsor on those occasions when I went to an AA meeting. And I woke up on the floor of this empty house looking up at these two guys. And the guy who became my sponsor brought this other new guy. And the new guy was dancing around me going, "Oh, my God, oh, my God. What are we going to do? Is he going to go into DTs? What's going to happen here? He looks pretty sick. Oh, my God. Should we get him some honey and orange juice? Or what do you think we ought to do? This looks like trouble. Oh, my God." If I would have had a gun, I would have shot this son of a bitch. He was appropriately named Dick. They took me to a halfway house. They didn't know what to do with me, so they knew that this priest over in this halfway house knew what to do with people like me. And so they drove me over there, and they plopped me down in front of this priest. And he said, "Are you an alcoholic?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Is your life unmanageable?" And I said, "For God's sake, they just dragged me in here." He said, "Are you done?" What the hell kind of a question is that? I said, "If I'm not, I'm dead." You know, my liver was sticking out of my side. I was turning yellow. I was in the terminal stages of alcoholism. And he said, "Do you believe in God?" Now, I don't know what the most prominent group of religious people is up here, but I was a German Lutheran, and I was sitting in front of a Catholic priest. And see, we couldn't even play with Catholics when I was a kid. And so he said, "Do you believe in God?" And I said, "No." And I did it just to piss him off. And he just... That's something I don't understand about us. We can be laying there dying in front of someone, and we still want to fight. What the hell is that? And he said, "Can you stop drinking?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, I got some bad news for you." And I said, "What's that?" And he said, "We can't stop you either. There aren't enough people in this whole city to stop you from taking another drink if you want one. And so if you can't stop and we can't stop you, there better be a God or game's over for you. And I get that. I mean, I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer, but I get that. Okay? And he said, so what do you think about that? And I said, well, I don't know. You know, I don't know how to connect with something like that. And he said, well, just pray. And I said, and I don't know what that looks like. I don't know anything about God. And he said, didn't you ever have any religious training? And I said, yeah, you know, I know now I lay me down to sleep and all that stuff, but I don't know what else. And he said, well, why don't you think about what you'd like God to be? And so I said, okay, and I started thinking about that, and then they took me home. Now, I knew what was going to happen. I'd been in DTs before. And I don't think they had any place to take you. So they just took me there. They took me back to the house they found me in. And they left me there. And I knew what was coming. And it scared the hell out of me. And I just sat there and waited for it. And you want to know the truth? I drank so much for so long I didn't care if it killed me. And then here it came. And for the next 48 hours, I rolled around on the floor like a fish out of water and flopping around and trying to pray and do all the rest of this. And a couple days later, they came back to see if I was still alive. Now, in the middle of that, the only thing that I remember was that I thought I was going to die every minute. I thought my heart would stop. And I saw ants the size of this podium coming out from under my refrigerator. And I had three cans of Raid in the basement steps. And I had a little tiny kitchen, and I ran back up to the kitchen with these three cans of Raid and tried to kill these giant ants. And I emptied all three cans of Raid in that little tiny kitchen and damn near asphyxiated myself. So anyway, they came back and picked me up and took me over to this halfway house again and sat me down in front of the priest again, and he said, so what do you think? And I said, I think that I'm amazed I'm still alive. And he said, what do you think about God? And I said, I'd like to believe that he would be like a father, because my father was a drunk and he was violent, and when you get next to him, you'd get beaten senseless or killed. And I'd like to have God be like a father who gives a damn about you, that cares about your welfare. And so he said, I think that's exactly what God is. And I started going to meetings there, and about the third day I went to a men's stag meeting. And I went in there, and these guys were all talking about how much fun they were having with their significant other physically. And when I got sober, I was impotent. And I'm sitting there going, I'm in the wrong fellowship here. Because nothing works for me. And I went to, after that meeting, I thought, I'm damaged here. And I went to see the priest, and I said, I need to ask you some questions, Father. And he said, what's that? And I said, I was just in a meeting, and these guys were all talking about how much fun they were having with their significant others. And I'm impotent. And he said, yeah. And I said, so what's the story on that? And he said, half of them are lying. And that's the first time I found out you could lie in an AA meeting. The book says that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we're like other people, or maybe, or presently maybe, which means or ever will be, has to be smashed. I am an alcoholic. You know, when I go back through the steps once a year, I always start with the premise that maybe I'm not. Well, I mean, if you don't have a first step, you don't have a program. And so I have to start with the premise that maybe I'm not, and I need to prove it to myself again that I am an alcoholic. And that's not a really tough job. So that's where I start. This priest turned out to be one of my best friends. He lives down in St. Paul, yet he's just a dear person. And he's been working with drunks for 45 years. And he said, "Oh, you want to go fishing with me?" And this was in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, and there's a 471 square mile lake right there called Lake Winnebago. And we'd go out on the lake and fish, and we'd talk about God. And because I'm sitting there fighting the whole idea yet. I didn't want to believe in that because I figured that I had screwed up so badly that if God really was there, that I was not on his list of friends. And he would do things that would just freak me out. We were sitting out on Lake Winnebago, which is a really shallow lake. I mean, most of that lake is about 6 feet deep. And here comes this, you know what, you guys know what clouds look like that have tornadoes in them? Big old black clouds that look like, you know, like they're solid. And one was coming at us, and we're sitting out in the middle of the lake in this boat. And I said, "Father, you need to pay attention to that." And he said, "Don't worry about it." And I said, "No, you ought to think about that, because this is a real dangerous place to be if it gets real windy." And he said, "Oh, all right." And then he went, and the cloud went off to the north. So help me. I told that in Minneapolis when he was in the audience, and he says, "I don't remember that." And I said, "I'll never forget it." The book says that if we're even willing to believe, upon this simple cornerstone, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. I can build a spiritual life on a willingness to believe. When the book talks about coming to believe in God, it talks about two different kinds of people. It talks about people who have what the book calls bedevilments, which they can't seem to be a real help to other people. They're prey to misery and depression. There's a whole laundry list of things in there. And then it talks about another type of people, and those are people with power, peace, happiness, and a sense of direction. You know, that's all I've ever wanted in life. I mean, power, peace, happiness, direction. What, that's about everything a person would ever want. And it says that the difference between those people that are really making heavy going out of life and the people with the power, peace, happiness, and a sense of direction is that the latter group of people have God as the central fact in their life. It's a compelling reason to believe in God. I became willing to believe. I just didn't know what to do with it. You know, my sponsor came up to me when I was 3 months sober, and he said, "Why are you sober?" And I said, because I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, bullshit. You'd been hanging around AA meetings for 5 years before you ever got sober. Something's different. And I said, well, I don't know what it is. And he said, well, think about it. Are you eating differently? And I said, no. And he said, are you going to work every day? And I said, nope. And he said, are you exercising? And I said, no. And he said, well, what are you doing differently? And I said, well, quit asking me. I don't know. And he said, are you praying? And I said, yeah. And he said, why are you doing that? And I said, because you told me to. And he said, what are you doing? And I said, that old stuff about, you know, pray in the morning if God keep you sober and thank him at night. And that's what I'm doing. And he said, is anything else different? And I said, no. And then this guy had a sixth grade education. He looked at me and he said, would you concede that you're sober today by the grace of a God you don't even believe in? About the time that happened, I moved to Denver. Went to work for a different company, and went to the mother house in Denver, which is called York Street. Incidentally, I can look out. I live in a south suburb of Denver. That's what Centennial is. I can look out the picture window in my living room and see the Rocky Mountains. And so I am no stranger to Calgary. You know, I spoke here 15 years ago, and I always felt good about the experience. You know, and Denver is a city that's part cow town, part oil town, in part metropolis. Does that sound like any city that you know? So anyway, I moved there, and I was down at York Street in a Sunday night meeting, and I heard this guy talk. And he was talking about the big book, and he was speaking about it as a textbook, in that it had a precise set of instructions in it that would not only keep me sober, it would change my life. And I listened to him, and I thought, I don't know that. And if I don't get some kind of solution, I'm living on borrowed time here. I need to go find somebody that's got a solution to this, because I didn't have one. I had stayed sober for almost a year on fear and fellowship. And so I went up to him after a meeting. His name was Don P. And I went up to him after the meeting, and I said, look, I haven't had a drink for almost a year, but I will drink again, and I can't survive this again. I came too close to dying the last time. And if I ever take another drink, I'm gone. And he said, would you be willing to go through the book with me? And I said, I'm willing to do anything. You sound like you've got a solution. And he said, well, tell me what you did. And I said, okay, well, I go to meetings and I try and be a nice person, and I don't know what else. And he said, well, it looks like you did everything but follow the instructions. And I would have rather died than to say to him, I don't know what the instructions are. Okay, but I didn't. And I said, whatever you got in mind. And he said, are you willing to sit across my kitchen table from me once a week and spend a couple hours and go through this book? And I said, yeah. Well, about that time, the 1975 International Convention came to Denver, and back then there were 19,000 people or something that showed up there, and we were all on the hospitality committee, and I can tell you that there was an individual from Canada that came down there and virtually revolutionized the way we did Alcoholics Anonymous. He was from Winnipeg, and his name was Mac Cheater. And we all listened to him talk, and our jaws dropped at the same time. And he talked about the Golden Slipper group in Winnipeg that just had terrible time staying sober. And then they decided they were going to change their whole approach towards Alcoholics Anonymous. And they were going to stop rationalizing about the steps. And they were going to stop intellectualizing about the steps. And they were going to stop doing all this stuff about the steps. And they were going to take an entirely new approach. They were going to do the steps. And he talked about that whole group getting together and starting at the forward to the first edition of Alcoholics Anonymous, where it says to show others precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. And then they started right there, and every time the book said, right, they wrote. Every time it said make a decision, they made a decision. Every time it said make amends, they went and made amends. They followed the directions explicitly from the beginning of the book all the way back to the stories. And an amazing thing happened to the Golden Slipper group in Winnipeg, and that is that they stayed sober. Fifteen of us at that convention decided that we were going to do exactly what Mac Cheater described. And we got together in this guy's basement. His name was Jay Levy. He's passed on now. And we started at the forward to the first edition, and we did everything that that book suggested, right by the numbers. Fourteen of us are either sober today from 1975, or they died sober. And the one exception was a guy named Eddie Durkin, and he decided that he wanted a drink. And he went out and got a drink. You know, Denver in the winter probably is a lot like Calgary, too. And Eddie Durkin froze to death in a doorstep on Larimer Street. But you want to know something? 14 out of 15 ain't bad. So we all got on our knees and said the third step together. It was a powerful experience. We all held hands and got on our knees in this guy's basement and said the third step prayer together, and then we all got up and started writing inventory. It was just wonderful. It's fellowship at its best. Do you understand about the fellowship of the Spirit? The fellowship of the Spirit that the book describes isn't a bunch of people huddled around in fear in an AA meeting. That's not the fellowship of the Spirit at all. The fellowship of the Spirit is the connection that we have with other people who have followed the directions. You can walk into an AA meeting and see who's done the steps. You know, if you can't do that, you probably haven't. We know intuitively who else has done this. And so people can sit in there and run their BS in front of you and talk about all sorts of ethereal things in AA meetings and be real, you know, just talk about weird stuff that I don't understand. And you look at them and you go, what the hell are you doing here? I think there's two choices here. I think if you come into Alcoholics Anonymous and you don't do the steps, and you don't engage in a recovery program, which is just absurd. what the hell are you here for? Don't you want to know who you can be? Don't you want to see where God can take you? Don't you want to see if this thing works? And people will come in and they won't do anything. And one of two things will happen. One of them is they'll stay just as crazy as the day they came through the door. And the other one is they'll drink. It's amazing. Maybe we're not the smartest people in the world. I don't know. But wouldn't you think that if you came in here and you had a clear-cut set of directions about how to get rid of this stuff, that you'd do that? It just drives me nuts. There's two things that drive me nuts. Well, there's probably about a dozen, but one of them is the people who come in don't do anything. And the other one is when people come in and stop too soon. I can't tell you what doing this over and over will do for you. There is, I scare people because my intuition works. And I asked this lady to have lunch with me the other day, and she said, no. Well, I'm an old single guy, see, so I asked this lady to have lunch with me, and she said, no. And I said, why not? And she said, because you know what I'm thinking before I think it. And see, one of the things that happens, and the book talks about intuitive thought, but if you keep writing inventory and doing amends and all this stuff over and over again, your intuition will grow to the point where it'll become scary to other people. Honest to God, go try it. Well, if there's anything I can do to encourage you to stay involved in this program, I'll do it. We all wrote inventory, I was talking to my sponsor, and he said, well, this is we read it in the book, too. It's about a grudge list. All people that you got angry at, which is pretty much everybody I'd ever met. And so I was on the road selling at the time, and so I'd get into a motel at night and I'd write down all these people that I'd been angry at. And then I'd come back and my sponsor would ask me if I was done yet, and it took me a while. And then I finally came back, and he said, in the second column you wrote down why you're mad at him, you don't have to write a lot there because you don't learn much. And then, does it affect your self-esteem, your security, your ambitions, your personal or sex relations? And I wrote all that stuff down. And then I came back after I got all that done, and I said, well, I'm done. And he said, no, you're not. And I said, what's left? And he said, you need to take each one of those resentments and answer questions. Where were you selfish? Where were you dishonest? Where were you self-seeking? And where were you frightened? And in that column, you're going to learn a lot about what you're up to. So I did that, and I went back, and I said, okay, I'm done. And he said, no, you're not. And I said, what's left? And he said, fear inventory. And I said, I was a bill collector in Chicago. I used to weigh 240 pounds and kick people's doors in and bang them up against the wall and do all that stuff. And I said, I don't have any fear. And he said, really, the book must be wrong. And I said, why? And he said, well, the book says that fear is an evil and corroding thread and that the fabric of our existence is shot through with it. And I said, well, mine's not. And I said, you know my history, Don. I mean, I was in all kinds of stuff in the military and did this bill collector thing in Chicago, and I just... just don't think I've got any. And he said, okay, well, humor me. And I said, okay. And he said, how about snakes? And I said, what kind of snakes? And he said, rattlesnakes. And I said, well, you'd have to be a fool to want to stand next to one. And he said, yeah, write down snakes. And I said, okay. And he said, how about spiders? And I said, you mean like black widows? And he said, uh-huh. And I said, well, Jesus, you wouldn't want one to bite you. And he said, no, write down spiders. How about failure? Oh, cheap shot. Well, you know, I grew up and people from the time I was about 10 years old told me I was either going to wind up in a mental institution like my mother or I was going to die in a gutter like my father. Nobody ever gave me a chance in hell. And when I was 12 years old, I didn't know why there was any point in keeping living because I wasn't going anywhere according to all these nice people. So he said, write down failure. How about inadequacy? And I said, nobody ever thought I'd amount to anything. And so I suppose. And he said, well, write down inadequacy. And he said, how about to police? And I said, Don, you know my history. I was sentenced to prison when I was 17 for assault with a deadly weapon. And then back then they said, well, you can do 4 years in the military instead of 4 years in prison, and we need people like you that like to shoot other people. People just loved me. Jeez. So anyway, he said, what do you think about the police? And I said, I don't like them. And he said, then write them down. And how about the courts? Well, the courts, you know, they sentenced me to this deal and had to go into military, and that was, I questioned that choice for some time. And so I didn't like them either. And he said, write down the courts. And how about women? Right. And I'm sitting there going, he said, write down women. How about children? And I said, just the real little ones. You know when they give you these newborn kids that are all wrapped up like they're little mummies? I don't want to hold them. I'm always afraid I'm going to drop them. And he said, write down infants. And so I wrote down infants, and then he didn't talk to me for about 3-4 minutes. And he said, is there anything you're not afraid of? And I said, I guess not. The book is right. We live in fear. And if fear doesn't work, terror does. And I can tell you where it comes from. It comes from the ego. Do you know that fear is the instrument of the ego? And if it wants you to do something, it'll make you afraid. And if just a little fear doesn't work, it'll put you in terror. One of the things that's really become apparent to me over time is that there are two antagonists here. One of them is our intuition, which is God's small voice that always tells the truth, and the other one is the ego. And the ego has some things about it that everyone should be aware of. Well, you know, we think when we grow up, people say, well, you got a big ego. And so we all think that it's us overblowing ourselves. But my ego doesn't do that. My ego said, hell, you're not going to amount to anything. You can't do that. You're going to look stupid. Everybody's going to come around and know that you are no good and never will amount to anything. and you go out and try that, and you are going to really look bad, and everybody's going to hate you. That's what my ego says. Okay? Here's what I can tell you about the ego. And this isn't psychology 101. This is right out of the big book. The ego always lies. The ego always wants something. The ego is never satisfied. You know what? I used to buy Corvettes. And then a week later, it was like I had the damn thing my whole life. And I would say, isn't this what you wanted? No. I'm not willing to play the game anymore, okay? I want to tell you that there is serious mental health in this process of recovery, in that I can tell you with absolute certainty that no matter how long you've been sober, I don't care if you've been sober 30 days, 30 months, 30 years, I don't care if you've been sober 50 years, if you continue to look for a spiritual experience, you will have one. I was 28 years sober, and I was talking to God in my 11th step, and I said, I want to know why, after writing inventory once a year for 28 years, that I still think that if other people really knew me, they wouldn't like me. I want to know why I still think I'm a fraud. I want to know why I think that the only reason why any woman would have anything to do with me was my ability to make money. I want to know why I still think I'm dumb lucky, and that the reason why I am a successful businessman is because everything just went my way. You know, take away all those years that I worked 12, 14 hours a day. Why do I still believe this stuff? Why do I think I will never be successful when I already am? Why do I believe things that fly in the face of obvious reality? Now, I'll tell you what happened to me, and you do whatever you want with it. I'm having a conversation with God, and all of a sudden I'm hearing something. And what I heard was principles. And I said, what the hell's that got to do with it? Principles are honesty, open-mindedness, willingness, stuff like that. And what I got told was, no, your principles are those beliefs that are so deeply embedded in your personality that they determine every decision that you make. If you spend your whole life believing that you're not good enough, you aren't. And it's your fault. You know, I got to tell you, I'm 70 years old, all right? The only reason why I come out and do this stuff anymore is because it just kills me to see people in Alcoholics Anonymous who stop too soon. I'm looking at this like this belief about if you really knew me, you wouldn't like me. And I say, and I'm asking this voice that's popping up in my head, which I am believing is my intuition. And I said, what do you do with it? And he said, put it in the first column. Okay, that sounds right. And I said, well, what do you do next? And he said, open your book. I opened my book, and at the top of the second column, it says the cause. And I thought, why do I believe that? And I believe that because I was told when I was a kid, as many of these beliefs come from, that I'd never amount to anything and that people weren't going to like me and I was just a bad kid. And then in the third column, it asks this question, does that affect your self-esteem? Duh. It destroyed my self-esteem. Does it affect your security? Yeah. secure. I can't be secure in relationships. I can't be secure in jobs. I can't be secure financially. I can't be secure in anything. Because I think everything's going to end because nobody likes me. Does it affect your ambitions? Yeah, there's no point. Why would I go do something if it isn't going to work? Does it affect your personal relations? Yeah, if nobody's going to like me, what's the point? Right? Does it affect your sex relations? Yeah, because sex relations are just personal relations on steroids. Where are you selfish? I know at some level. Yeah, let me tell you, but I was having lunch with a customer. Big customer. And he said something about, well, you've gone out and done all these different things and been so successful at business. And I said, well, you know, I'm just a farm kid from Wisconsin. Just fresh off the manure spreader. Right? And he was so mad at me. And he said, Bob, you're one of the most astute business people we know, and why you're telling that kind of lie about yourself is very confusing to me, and knock it off. Okay? I have never met anyone in Alcoholics who knew who they were. And the only way to find that out is to get rid of this kind of horse manure that's floating around between our ears. So I know at some level that I'm not the person who I think I am. And that's why it's selfish, because I'm not even willing to stir it up to drag this thing out of my personality and find out if it's true or not. And where is it dishonest? It's dishonest to believe a lie. You know, I've been writing that inventory for 8 years already, and I haven't gotten to the bottom of it. Why is it self-seeking? Because it allows me to be a victim. See, I can excuse any failure. I can stop any effort. I can explain away any bad circumstances by saying, well, you know how I am. Two of the greatest lies in the world are, that's the way it is, and that's the way I am. I was married to a woman, one of my two unsuccessful marriages, who said, but that's the way I am. And I went, you know, when somebody says that to you, you know what it means? I'm not changing. My mind is closed. That's the door slamming, okay? What are you going to do with that? So I had a question on there, and the question is this a lie? And if it's a lie, I just can't believe it anymore. And I would encourage you to write inventory about what you believe. Those became my principles, okay? I'm not going to have time to go through all this stuff, but let me just share some general things with you. There was a guy in Denver that I didn't like at all. He'd been sober longer than I was. He was about 6'6". And about 300 pounds, and had played football at one point for the New York Giants. He was a lawyer. He was really contentious, combative, aggressive. I hated him. And he'd come up to me and he'd go, hey, Olson, what are your principles? And I went, excuse me? And he said, well, you live by principles, don't you? And I said, hopefully. And he said, what are they? And I said, I'm not sure. I'd have to think about that. And he said, then you don't have any. One day he walked up to me and he said, "Do you have the courage of your convictions?" And I said, I knew better by then. And I said, "Yes." That's a question I want to ask you. Look, we get a lot of strange people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and some people belong there and some people don't. And if you want to argue with that, you got your head up your backside. There are people who will come into Alcoholics Anonymous and they will virtually cry out for help. And sometimes the way they cry out is by acting like they don't want to do anything in here. And every once in a while they get turned so far inward that you have to yank them out. All right? You have to say something really rude, like, "When are you going to pull your head out of your ass?" And every time you do that, you will alienate everyone else in the AA meeting. Right? Get over it. You know, if somebody's dying in front of you, are you willing to stop the process even if it makes you look bad? Do you have the courage to stand up and tell someone the truth when lies are killing them? Do you? Do you have the courage to keep looking? Do you believe that if you live a spiritual life and you continue to look for a spiritual experience that you will have another one no matter how long you've been sober? You know what the essence of a spiritual experience is? It's going from "where's mine" to "what can I do for you?" Okay? That's where you see people that are sober, people who understand this program, people who really are in the recovery process. They're out there trying to help others. And if you're not doing that, you better start asking yourself some questions. And that is, what the hell are you up to? You know likes attract in AA, don't you? And that step workers hang out with step workers and bullshitters hang out with bullshitters? Do you know that? Take a look at who you're hanging out with. If your group isn't strong enough, make it strong enough. Take a position. Figure out what you believe in. If you see someone constantly breaking the traditions, do you know that Alcoholics Anonymous is about alcoholism? It's not about "I am an alcoholic and something." It's about "I am an alcoholic," and if you're talking about anything else, it's an outside issue and you are breaking the traditions. This is about drinking. Well, you've been a lovely group. And you know what? I wish you could all have all the experiences that I've had. And you can. All you got to do is stay after it. All you have to do is continue to seek God. And you will have the most miraculous things happen to you. You know, my two youngest sons are 16. And they had their spring football scrimmage today, and I am so excited. Those two sons are 6'2 and 6'3, and they both weigh 230 pounds, and they're 16 years old. And you know, I don't go talk in September, October, November, and December because they play football every weekend. And that's what my life looks like. I am surrounded by people who love me. You know, there's nobody in my family that won't talk to me. My kids all love me. My grandkids love me. I am surrounded by a host of friends. And Alcoholics Anonymous will give you the most outrageously good life if you allow it. So thank you so much.